Hello, motion picture brains. That's you. Fans of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros, and ones. Welcome back to another episode of the Craft Truck Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with a cinematographer. In this episode, we spoke with the unbelievably infectious Amy Vincent, who is known for, amongst other things, the films of Yves Bayou, Hustle and Flow, also from Craig Brewer. She shot Jawbreaker. She also shot recently Black Snake Moan and also Footloose. And as well as all of that, she's done a ton of second unit photography. She knows, she's forgotten more about the inside of a camera than we'll ever know. What follows is the uncut audio of my conversation with Amy. We met her in Los Angeles in the apartment of Michael May in around June of 2012. And we have to give another thanks to Michael May, who's unbelievably cool. And if you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, you will find it at www.crafttruck.com as Season 1, Episode 8 of Through the Lens, or youtube.com/crafttruck. You can also subscribe if you're getting lonely. It should be noted that during this interview, Amy bench pressed 350 pounds.
Sink, Sam.
All right, we'll sink. Ready? High five. Bam!
There this is go. My screen test.
Yeah, this is. Amy Vincent, finally, on camera.
I'm going to do a commercial for microdermabrasion. Sun damage vacation.
Can we get like one of those graphics that pops out? We'll just freeze frame into...
You know, yeah, like that'd be cool.
That'd be awesome.
A little micro, yeah.
Welcome back to another regularly special episode of Through the Lens. I feel like every time I say that, I just want to fall all over the subject.
Don't do that.
Amy Vincent, cinematographer, person of parts. Really, what I want to talk about more than anything, is the fact that you were an assistant sound editor.
You don't want to apparently. Talk about that.
Oh,
do
no,
you?
On American Ninja.
Yes. Well,
come on.
You forgot
American
I
Ninja.
Was also an assistant sound editor on Missing in Action Part 2, starring Chuck Norris.
Huge.
No, it wasn't just Missing in Action Part 2. It was Missing in Action Part 2, the beginning. But it was made after.
That's amazing how they did that. That was actually ahead of its time, because the whole idea of reboots and, you know.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, so what you were in, you have the career, it seems, just looking at your resume, and I don't know what the real story is. We want to get the real story, but you've worked your way up. You beat, scratched, clawed your way up through the system. What was the decision to go from sound to camera?
My little interim in the editing room was really came out of the first job I could get when I moved to Los Angeles. I had, you know, stars in my eyes. I went to college in Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, during the punk rock days, and we had a film program, and I made some kind of edgy black and white movies.
Edgy.
It's
like Michael Mann always talks about, like film school is the perfect place to do stuff you would never get away with when you're...
Yeah, I made a couple of black and white movies, and I wrote them, directed them, shot them.
Awesome. What were they about?
One was about a carbon monoxide suicide. It was called Autobody, and it had my friend Celinda, who was really beautiful, in a Volvo P1800, naked, trying to kill herself. And it was all these, like, sexy shots of, like, the tube and the carbon monoxide coming out of it and her body and the car body.
Because most people who commit suicide do it naked.
It was super 1979/1980. Kind of stuff.
Right.
But no, seriously, I applied to graduate school at UCLA so that I could facilitate the move to Los Angeles, because everybody said, oh, you know, they don't really do, in Northern California is not a film capital of the world. Right. So I got accepted there, and the cinematography program was just plain not technical enough for me. What I really needed and wanted was hands-on experience, and so I partied a little too much, and I finished the first year, and I didn't complete it. And I got my first job was a work-study job. My very first job in Hollywood, this is very glamorous, was a work-study job, and I was working in the Warner Brothers archives, which is at Romaine and Cahuenga, in a place called the Television Center building, which is home to some porn distributors, too.
Yeah. So that's when you started shooting porn.
Well, my job was to wind through these old deteriorated silver nitrate prints and cut out the sticky parts where the film was starting to deteriorate. So I literally, I was like, I have my first job in Hollywood. And I was in this cinder block room with a respirator mask on and winding through until I heard the sticky sound. And then you look and it's all like brown and gooey and you cut, you know,
just Humphrey Bogart's right
close up right out of the movie. Anyway, you had to throw your clothes away after stuff. Anyway, that was my first job. And I managed to turn that into getting an assistant editor's card in the union, and then those were the jobs I was able to get, and I needed work, so I took them. It wasn't where I wanted to be. It took me about 4 years, I would say, to complete my run in the editing room. Now, today, I'm very grateful to have had that time. At the time, being of the sort of the punk rock spirit, I was like, I got to get on set, and so I would ask every producer that I worked for, you know, if they had an internship in the camera department. And it's not that unsimilar to how it could work for younger people coming up today. Although I was so naive. I had never been on a real film set in my life, but I was sinking dailies and I was going, yeah, I want to do that Slate thing. anyway, one of the producers that I had been working for actually came through. And I had been at a rap party for some dumb movie. That producer ends up being John Wells of TV, you know, celebrity fame.
Right.
I interviewed for Shameless. That brat didn't hire me. But, anyway, this was way long time ago. Yeah. And he said, well, you know, it seems like you're really good at your job, but I know you don't like it, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, I really want to get into the camera department. And he said, okay, and he wrote down this stuff, and he said, they're starting shooting this movie. These are my friend, so-and-so, call them. And, yeah, we were drinking and partying. It was back in the day. And I was like, okay, cool. And I woke up the next morning, and my phone was ringing, and it was him. And he said, you know, if you got to leave, like, right now if you want to go do this internship, and they'll take you. So I said, okay. And I drove to Santa Fe, New Mexico. It was March. I had no idea there was snow in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You know, I was young. I was from the East Coast. I had my Jack Purcell sneakers and my beat-up old BMW 2002, and I jumped in the car with about $20. And I drove to where the movie was shooting, and they didn't want an intern. But
the story is just getting better and better.
The movie was called And God Created Woman. It was a remake. It was awesome.
Was it about
starring Rebecca De Mornay in the?
Was she committing suicide in the back of a car with?
And God Created Woman, the original one, was a Roger Vadim production. Cut to Roger Vadim's directing the remake, you know, 20 whatever years later. Anyway, that was my first on-set experience, and I sort of took it from there in the classic way that you would, where I kept working for free and doing whatever anybody would let me do, and eventually I started getting paid for it. I think $50 a day was what I got on Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers. That was another one. That should still be on my IMDb page. I was a loader on that one. I hope they didn't take it off, because that's one of my favorite credits. It's really cool.
What year was that?
I don't know. It was a long time ago.
There it is. Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers, second assistant camera.
Yeah.
1988.
It's on there. Yeah. 1988. See, it's up in that one.
That's awesome.
Anyway, I happened to be fortunate enough to be a second assistant on a movie that was organized by the union, so I got my union card, and I think I got it in 88, actually. Mm-hmm. And I've moved my way up.
Significantly.
Yes, but I was a terrible focus puller. Terrible first assistant.
Well, when you're drunk, it makes it real hard to get that distance going, you know.
Well, I was a great second, and I really loved seconding, and then...
What was hard about first? Was it just the nerve-wracking?
I think it's one of the hardest jobs on set, and there are some people whose brains are built for that kind of stuff, and it was very, very stressful for me, and I could achieve it, but I did not enjoy it.
Did you know from the beginning you wanted to be a cinematographer?
No.
When did that realization hit? Was it the first time you took a photograph and went, oh, I actually like
it? I would say that it was a developing thing. I mean, I thought that, you know, that was what my interest was the photography and the lighting. And mm-hmm. then I happened to connect with a cameraman whose name is John Lindley, who he became my mentor.
Yeah.
And he would entrust me with a lot of stuff. Like, we used to use these old black and white Polaroid pictures to evaluate exposure or keep records of it when you're matching a scene and things like that. And he would let me take all the Polaroids and write all, you know, T28 on the things and stuff. And that was really where it started developing. And that was on, I mean, becoming a reality in terms of, okay, this is how it works on the movie set, and this is where I have to go to get from here to there. It's a pretty different than, like, film school, Super 8, black and white, you know, stolen shots on the streets of Santa Cruz. Which I can't wait to make a movie like that again. It'd be so fun to go make a movie, like, with two people in a lock.
I know, yeah.
And a stick and a piece of string. That's all you need.
Why would it be great to make a movie like that? Because it's just so freeing to not have the machinery and the ponderousness and the, you know, the...
Can we get there in a minute?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, I was telling you that I was not a particularly gifted focus puller, mm-hmm. and so I skirted through that part of the department pretty quickly. I started operating, and
so you just found a way to kind of get through that.
Yeah, and one of the ways of doing that was that after I'd been working in the camera department for quite some time, I went to AFI. I applied, I got in. I was making pretty good money by my standards as a camera assistant, and I was enjoying it. And then I applied, and then I was on a movie called Father of the Bride, and mm-hmm. one of the camera operators just did not see the place for women in the camera department. And that was all news to me. I wasn't even aware that was an exception to the rule. So I guess blindness and naivete.
Okay,
Yeah. Thank you. You can correct me.
No problem. I'll correct everything.
As long as it's not a Canadian correction.
No. It's French.
You know, and so I wouldn't say I didn't make the choice blindly, but I also did not know at the time. I didn't know the statistics, and I didn't know that element, the female, the gender element, was going to come into play quite as much as it has in the history of cinematography and in my own career and other people around me. But the sort of end of this story is that I was working with John Lindley, and he said, well, you have to go. I was still on said movie when I got the acceptance letter. And AFI for me was really about letting other people know what I wanted to do and kind of seeing if I had what it takes. Because there's a whole bunch of stuff you can learn on set, but there's stuff that you just have to do it to... And I had an interesting time at AFI because I had a lot of on-set experience already. I was quite popular as a person that people wanted to have shoot their movies, so I got to do a lot of shooting. And the rest, you know, there's a stretching out of time that happens. Like, you stop second assisting, you've been operating a little, you go to film school, you make a bunch of movies, you come out of film school, and you've got to go back to second assisting to get your health insurance and make some money, and then the cameramen you work for gives you an operating job, and then it takes 3 years to get your first movie, and you shoot a bunch of short films for free and all that stuff. And I did all that, and I don't regret any of it, except maybe American Ninja.
That was
sound effects.
Let's be honest. I mean, it's only downhill from there. The minute you do American Ninja, you know.
That guy's still around. Michael Dudikoff is his name.
I know, and he's so good looking.
I don't know what happened to him. Anyway.
Anyway.
You were asking.
I was going to ask. Okay, so...
So you'll chop that into, like, section, right?
No. We're just running it uncut. So there's actually a few questions that came up there, because obviously being a female cinematographer, why is it such an overwhelm? Why are there so few... I mean, there are certain departments in the film business that are historically either heavily populated or mostly populated by women. They used to call the continuity supervisor script girl. This is on the credits, script girl, right? Obviously, we don't do that anymore. Casting directors, a lot of people. Why is it that when it comes to cinematographers, there are so few women shooting? Do you have a reason for it? Is it because it's a male dominated field, and that guy that you encountered, it's like it's either there subconsciously in the rest of them, or
I think it's a That's a huge question, and I've been trying to answer it for about 25 years. First and foremost, I think that the American, and probably Canadian as well, the American family structure is not set up for the woman to be gone from the house for extended periods of time, whether it be for a 15-hour workday or for a 15-week location shoot. That being said, I think a lot of women will choose marriage and children over career, and there's nothing wrong with that. Or they will try to do both, but, you know, the ideal thing would be to have, like, a hugely successful screenwriter husband who wanted to take care of all your babies while you were off shooting great movies.
Right.
But the chances of that happening more than a couple times,
Slim.
Yeah, so, that's one of the reasons. I think it's a big reason. I think it's just kind of the way the world works. But the bigger reasons are they're sadder to me than those that...
Uh-huh.
I'll cite an example. I was at the X Games on Sunday, and they were the motocross enduro finals, and I'm a motorcycle rider, and I'm pretty awesome at it. And I was the kid, okay, and my... Growing up, I was number three of four girls. My dad always wanted a boy. And so by the time he had me, he was
he
was just
going to
make me a boy no matter what.
Right.
So I know how to shoot guns and ride motorcycles and all that stuff.
You can shoot guns?
Yeah, not here.
Not in front of us?
No.
Do you own any models in particular?
Let's not go there.
Okay, fine. We'll just
that could get me in trouble.
All right.
I do... You know, the motocross finals on Sunday, there were all the men's finals, and then there was they did the women's finals, and there's just this presupposition that the women are weaker and can't do it, and they change the height of the ground underneath this section of the
track.
Enduro course that they call the matrix, and it was just, I was kind of like, really?
Right.
But what it boiled down to in that context is that the body mass of these women is so light that they can't get through some of this stuff, comparatively speaking. So I'm just saying that they made a big deal, the announcers at the X Games, this is where I have an issue. It's like, don't make it like it's such a big deal that these chicks are riding motocross enduro. They've all been training their whole lives. Now, their lives may be, some of them were only 18 years old, but don't promote it as an exception, like,
right.
Say, isn't it great now that we've come this far? It was only a few years ago that women even had a entry spot in motocross in the X Games. Anyway, that was a divergence. I think that any jobs that are inherently physical in combination with scientific and technical, I think there's a gender bias on that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Those aren't the only things that we do. I mean, cinematography is kind of the most awesome job in the world because we're collaborators, we're artists, we're technicians, we're craftspeople, we're
yep.
personnel managers,
yep.
we're, you know, usually the number one collaborative creative partner with the director. And there's so many things in that list of things that any gender could be good at, you know.
Right.
It's unfortunate. I think some women have been afraid of statistics. I think that the world of cinematography has been a good old boys club for a really long time. I mean, the statistics are insane.
Right.
The camera union is... I don't want to cite the statistics without knowing them exactly, but the male-to-female the numbers are unlike any other profession. I mean, there's more female astronauts, senators, whatever you want to say.
Right.
So, you know, what can we do about that is a better question. I work a lot in education. I also I am definitely gender biased in my hiring in terms of the younger people in the department to get more female camera people in general, whether they end up becoming cinematographers remains to be seen sometimes, but take female interns. What happened
We'll just turn that off. Just for the fun of it.
That would be a fine on set or something.
Why not? That'd be. Well, I'm going to find myself.
I think also I work a lot in education. As I said, I also work to help employ talented and capable women.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all of the women working in this gender-swayed profession really need to, they need to be beyond excellent. They need to be accomplished beyond a shadow of a doubt, and they need to perform in a way, because what reflects off me reflects on to everybody, every right. other woman. So I think taking that sort of socially responsible in terms of your performance and presentation on set, whether it be your the way you dress, the fact that you can carry that big heavy camera, shocking, isn't it? and the fact that when you say put a T2-8 on that lens, that you're technically specific. You're not being a bitch. You're being technically specific. But there's a lot of, you know, I think the gender stuff exists in the world, unfortunately. I think there are a lot of men who don't care for women and vice versa. Unfortunately, cinematography has remained the last, the final frontier of gender discrimination. And quite frankly, I think some people just give up. Thankfully, I didn't know. When I embarked on my journey, that
the
I was
ignorance was a
yeah, but I probably would have done it anyway if I'd known or right. done it quicker. But just, that's just my personality.
Just to be a rebel.
And you know, it continues. It's not like I broke through anything. It continues. It's there are still probably many, many, many movies that I wouldn't be considered for because I'm a girl, and it might be just because of, you know, if it's a movie about a trucker, then maybe I'm not the right person because I'm not a big guy or something. I don't know. It's hard to explain, and I have had to navigate my way through without becoming negative or fighting too hard against it. I just keep pushing forward and do what I can to, you know, make my mark in the work and in the presence on set. I bring as many women, as I said, as many capable women as I can with me. I remember when I met my who's now continued through many, many years as my first assistant cameraman, I put out this, like, APB. I need, like, the best female focus puller in the world. And that's how I met Jamie Fells, who's worked with me by my side for many, many years now. But can you imagine? It's like you're a female first assistant camera person working for a female DP, and something goes wrong. It must be because you're a girl. So, I'm just kidding. But, you know, it's funny. It's not funny at all, and it's something that it's kind of the number one question that people ask me, and I ponder it all the time.
Right.
And
but, you know, is the saying, whatever saying you want. I mean, the fact is, you're doing your best to change it. You're shooting beautiful pictures. You're, you know, they're you know, we can only hope that as the time goes by that, you know, the gender statistics will even out.
I think there's another factor in it too, that I think that right now there's a huge kind of movement amongst ASC members to elevate and reignite the importance and the vitalness of cinematography and the director cinematographer collaboration. And cinematography is an art form, because in this day and age of iPhones and GoPro cameras, I have one, I love it. The art of cinematography is easily diluted, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, in terms of the director cinematographer relationship, I hate to say it, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I think there are some male directors who get confused about who's a good, fun buddy to go out and drink beers with, as opposed to who's a great collaborator, cinematographer, and, you know, I'm not ever going to be the great, fun guy to go out and drink beers with.
But that's
with.
Not true. You told us you had your first job because you were out partying and drinking.
Well, that was 20,
aren't we
that
going
was
out?
30, 20-something years ago.
Aren't we going out and drinking later?
I'm a sober person, too.
Oh, okay.
You can go.
It's okay. I am, too. I really don't drink. Okay, so I want to talk about some of the pictures that you've done, because, okay, so tell us, how did Eve's Bayou come about? Because this is a movie. It's an independent movie. Back when making an independent movie was much, in some ways, a more difficult thing to achieve and certainly to get out there. It was a movie that, if I'm not mistaken, made the top 10 lists of almost every critic that year. Ebert, Siskel at the time, both put it on their
I know, Roger Ebert said my name on television.
It must have been like, you know, every major...
I love that.
It was just like this film that was you don't find these films being made that often anymore. Like, it's like a real drama hit, sleeper hit. How did you get that job? And tell us about making it. You know.
Okay, the getting of the job. I was still at AFI. Mm-hmm. We were all in our second year finishing up our thesis films, mm-hmm. and I had shot a million short films for free, and I was kind of very ready to just get to work.
Right.
And one of my producing colleagues at AFI, got that right, his name is Jim Wilson, he came to me and he said, you know, I'm working for this producer, and he's got a script, this short film that he wants to get shot for some actress, and are you interested? And I said, no, I'm done with that stuff. I'm over it. It wasn't a bad attitude thing. It was just like, I was so burnt out.
Yeah.
And then he said, no, I think you should really take a look at this. And so I read the short film, and I was like, okay, it's good. And they said, well, will you meet with the director? And that was Casey Lemons. And she came to see my thesis film, and then she wanted to meet with me, and... they were making the short film so that she'd kind of have a calling card as a director because she was an actress. We made the short to go along with Eve's Bayou. Well, oh, I forgot one part. I read the Eve's Bayou script, and it was one of the best scripts that I had ever read. And I was just like, okay, I'll shoot 10 short films more.
If it means.
Yeah. So I have to shoot this movie. So Casey and I met. We totally hit it off. And we made the short film with, like, friends and borrowed C-stands, and then Cotty Chubb was the producer, and I have to extend my gratefulness to him because he kept us together after we did the short film. You know, he was going out and shopping the movie to get the financing, and cut to 3 years later, but Cotty put a clause in the deal that said that Casey Lemons and I wouldn't be separated, because oftentimes, especially back then, they would try to give a new young director, especially writer-director, a seasoned...
DP.
Yeah. Somebody with some experience. And, you know, I love that movie so much because if I knew then what I know now, I probably wouldn't have taken all those chances. And I fought for photographic integrity against probably the better judgment of politics and other stuff. I mean, it's like, we have to shoot that shot at this exact time because that's when the sun set reflects in the water in the foreground when they're walking over the bridge, that kind of stuff.
And they looked stunning. Those images looked stunning. I mean, you know.
It's sort of like losing your virginity. It's like at that time, that is the most important thing that's happening, and then you realize afterwards that other stuff. But it was not an easy movie to get made. Casey and I formed quite a strong partnership, and it was a very visual partnership. And like I said, we made the whole movie. It was 3 years between when we did the short film and when we got to actually shoot Eve's Bayou. And I remember we were driving to work on the first day of shooting, and we saw the little yellow location sign that said Eve pointing that way. And Casey and I turned to each other, and we're like, oh, my God, they're really letting us make this movie. And then we saw the trailers and stuff. It was like, because it had been 3 years. It was pretty exciting. But
And then after the movie comes out, it's this huge success. What was it like? Was there an expectation on my life? It's gonna be completely changed, or did it change, or what was the?
You know, from the shooting of the movie to when the movie came out was a long, period because you've been there, and you know there was stuff that I didn't know about what you fight for and what you don't, and I may have, you know, made things harder for myself by fighting for the photographic integrity, as I said, then I might not make that choice today just because you want to get another job. And I don't mean to say that I believe that nobody really cares about cinematography, but sometimes you have to make a choice whether it's better to get this done on the schedule and the budget that you have or to make the most beautiful shot. And
in history, right?
Yeah, so... Now, all that being said, I think you understand where I'm going with that.
I really appreciate you saying that because this is the sort of thing that, you know, some people, I mean, everyone looks back in their career and they have moments where they go, you know, but it's those, it's that regret.
But thank heaven that, yeah. You know, I made one movie.
well, you made a few more.
There was a little bit of a lull in there, you know, between that and when the movie came out. And then I would be the go-to person for movies with African-American actors in them after that. And
so explain, does the pigeonhole, I mean, we talk of talking with other cinematographers about pigeonholing, and I always find it pretty shocking. You know, my thought is, you want to shoot a comedy, get the guy who shot 15 horror films. He's dying to do something different, you know, and it's not like he doesn't understand,
right.
You know, or she doesn't understand what that, you know, you want to shoot a horror movie, get the photographer who shot a bunch of comedies, you know. There's this, to such a degree, you can shoot half-hour TV, you can't shoot an hour TV. That's the way, you know, the studio system looks at it, you know. What, you know, did you get pigeonholed to a certain degree? I mean, is there any benefit to that part of business?
The pigeonholed sounds like it has a little negative connotation. I think that I would take it as a compliment that people could see something in the way that I was able to light mixed skin tones and choices that I made. And I took all those choices in different directions in different movies. I mean, Hustle and Flow is about as different looking a movie as than Eve's Bayou. But it really boils down to, that stuff really boils down to just the basics of lighting and really looking at what you're shooting and making decisions about reflectance angles and color and softness and intensity and all the basic things that we deal with. But I had a time when I was kind of the go-to kid for, I wasn't a kid. I was the kind of the go-to indie.
We had to cut because it stops rolling. So I already started rolling. Can you just resync and keep going?
29 minute clip limit.
Oh my goodness.
It's so offensive.
You just, that was the slate? Okay, cool. It's a different world these days.
I know.
Marker. No, we had slates back then.
We had reels.
We shot film.
Show us how it's done. Come on, show us the form.
No.
Come
on! Yeah. I loved that job.
I know.
It was really fun. It was easy, too. It was no stress. Well, low stress, I should say. Pigeonhole. Pigeonhole. But, you know, I like the fact that people see, and then they say, oh, I like what she did there, and that has something that I want to do in my movie. What I don't like is repeating myself. It's like I used to get scripts that were derivative of Eve's Bayou for a few years.
Right.
You know, set in the South and little girl, black family stuff. And that wasn't really very interesting to me. But yes, you do get, once people have seen one thing that you've done, then they say, okay, I know that she can do that, and so they'll ask you to do that again. And, you know, I don't think we live in a day and age right now where you can say, oh, I'm not going to do that because I want to do something different. It's like you kind of got to, work is not as prevalent in our world right now as it used to be in terms of sort of mid-range, high-end feature,
yeah.
Mid-range budget, drama.
They've kind of dropped out and disappeared.
A little bit.
Yeah. Like the $5 to $8 million range is pretty much gone.
Yeah, let's not talk about that right now. but yes, I think it happens in any job, in any art form. I think, you know, we're a gun for hire in many ways, and people will base their decisions on that, on what you've done in the past. And then you try to reinvent yourself, and that's an interesting journey, too.
Can we talk for a second a little bit about Hustle and Flow?
Yes.
So
those are my two favorites.
It was a great picture. My understanding is that, you know, Craig Brewer has this script that he's dying to make, and I heard him say in an interview is basically his story of trying to become a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Put into a different, you know, into an analogous tale. And no more water.
We need mojito. I'm fine.
and he goes, and John Singleton somehow picks it up and says, I love this, and goes to Susan, this is my guy, this is his script, I'm backing this, you know, and nobody will step up to finance it. Nobody. So after
John Singleton didn't come in, just a little correction. Okay. John Singleton wasn't part of that process until the very end.
Okay.
The movie had several different incarnations through which it was going to be made. I met Craig through Stephanie Elaine, who she and I went to college together at UC Santa Cruz. She was a dancer and I was a theatrical lighting designer. And we were working on a movie called Biker Boys together, Stephanie and I. I was shooting the second unit and she gave me Craig's first movie. It was like this dirty VHS cassette tape. And she said, hey, take this home and watch it and tell me what you think. And I didn't know what it was. I thought it might have been her kid's NYU film or something.
Right.
And I went home and I watched this movie. It's called The Poor and Hungry. And it was amazing. It was all shot in... this thing's moving around. It was shot in high 8 black and white. You know, standard def video.
Yeah.
And Craig shot it himself with his, I think it was his brother-in-law who was his only crew with like little clip lights. They got it at the hardware store. And I was like, I love this dude. It's like, by whatever means necessary. And so we met and we happened to have two friends in common who were Bernie Imes, the still photographer, and also William Eggleston, who lives in Memphis. And is a Bernie is a friend of Craig's and Eggleston was a friend and obviously one of the greatest color still photographers in the world. I had met him through Cotty Chubb on Eve's Bayou. He was the still photographer. So that was our jumping off point visually. We totally hit it off. And then again, in some ways, like Eve's Bayou, we had an incredibly long amount of time to get ready to make the movie. And we were at one time going to make the movie for $4 million through MTV Films with Andre from Outkast in the lead, and Craig just couldn't make that work for obvious reasons. Then it went through some much bigger budget version that was going to be tied up in legal things with Universal forever, so that didn't work. And then Stephanie sold her house to, and we were going to do it, you know, for $350,000 or something. And then that was like a year and a half. That was 18 months of that stuff. And then Stephanie and John were obviously partners before. From Stephanie produced Boys in the Hood when John was, you know, fresh out of college. And
21 years old.
So Stephanie went to John and said, hey, give me some money. in a very Stephanie Elaine fashion. She's so awesome. She just says what she wants and gets it. She's, you know, she and Craig had done an awful lot of hard work to get the movie made, and John came in with some money, and the rest is sort of history. It was $2.5 million. We had 24
Sundance for, I think it was $8 million or something. It was a huge sale.
Yeah,
Sundance, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that stuff is, we made the movie for $2.5 million.
Yeah,
and then I was out of the country when it opened at Sundance, and, you know, of course, I'd seen the movie a million times doing the color timing and everything, and I knew that I thought it was great, but I had no idea, and Stephanie was calling me and emailing me. I was in Thailand at the time doing some international women filmmakers thing or something. Had I only known,
right,
I might have made a different choice, but Stephanie's like, it blew up, the studio executives are walking out singing It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp. And I flew straight to Sundance, so I got there for the second big screening, and it was crazy. It's like, it was already like the, you know, the buzz film of the festival, and it was so cool to see, like, and people were, like, standing up and cheering, and Craig's a very good entertainer in and of himself. He's not just a great filmmaker, but, you know, he can work a crowd when he introduces a movie and things like that, so that was really great. And then it's an interesting thing, and we were just talking about this. I know you have a time limit, so I'll make it quick.
No,
but in history now, Hustle and Flow is considered a flop because it was made for $2.5 million. Then Paramount bought it for $9 million, I believe, and then they spent some money on the print B&A, and advertising.
Yeah.
And when all the numbers were crunched back down, ultimately the movie on paper didn't make any money. So then it became, it was a failure. And it's just, to measure a movie's success or failure in terms of dollars, to me, just, it's just, I love that movie. And I love that it, the process of making it was what the movie is about as well. It was just, we didn't have any extra things. I mean, no fancy tools. And, you know, our camera car was like the Grips pickup truck with a bunch of speed rail rigged on it, and it was fun.
What is your approach to photography? I mean, is it every movie is a different, completely different, you know, set of visual tools and ideas and language, or is it? Do you have? If you can, you can you explain how you approach?
I try to do the exact same thing every time.
No,
of course. Every film is different, and it really comes from the script. And sometimes you build up what your visual language is going to be based on historical things, based on inspiration that comes from the director, based on locations, based on, you know, emotional, dramatic use of color, all the different tools that we have combined to make intentional filmmaking. So it comes from the script and the director initially, and they're all different. They're all completely different. Mm-hmm. Like, I did shoot Jawbreaker, and everybody has to have a high school murder movie, but that movie's visuals were based on anything that's round and anything that's candy-colored and shiny, and if you look at it, it's not meant to be something that the audience gets out of there and goes, wow, everything was candy-colored and shiny, and it was all round.
But it's in there.
But that was the guiding light for myself and the production designer to sort of make a visual language. These are the parameters within which this story is going to be told. That's not my favorite movie.
Are you ever?
Although it has a moment.
Amy Vincent, being honest.
It has a moment. But no, every, you know, that I think, and that's sort of what I think separates. In prep, when you're preparing to make a movie, that's when the hard part is going on. That's when you're making the movie on paper. And once you're ready to make it, everything's been, schedules have been made and equipment has been ordered and all that stuff. And when you actually get to shooting, in some ways, the higher level creative stuff should be the first ball going down the hill. It's like, you already made it. Now it's execution.
Right.
Of course, there's creative work and collaboration and, you know, compromise and inspiration that happens at every scene and every day on set, but the structural, the creative structure, the visual structural groundwork needs to be
in place,
developed in prep, and
got it.
It's terrifying to go to shoot for a day when it's not properly prepped and you don't really know what's going to happen, but it can be fun too.
Jeff,
yeah.
Can I switch one second?
You want to switch cards? Yeah, sure.
Talk too much. Same as the Epic. The Epic has the big sensor.
Yeah, make you a bet.
Really?
How much do you want to bet?
Maybe I don't know.
It's the same MX sensor. The issue is that what it will not use the full sensor when it's shooting. It can only do 4K, whereas the Epic can do 5K.
Really?
Yeah. It's not like it re-resolves the same area. It just uses more of the chip. It's like a pain in the ass because it's like it's there, but it just...
Why would you do that?
Because, well, to make a
price. So the sensor's the same size?
Sensor's the same size. I can even shoot the full sensor if I only shoot 6 frames per second. That's a limit on the frame rate, right? So this will do, at 24 frames per second, it'll do 4K. And then if I want to go faster, by the time I get to 120, it'll only do like 1K.
Huh.
Like, it's not the resolution, it's just the fact that it's using less of the sensor.
But the sensor's...
The same.
Okay, I thought it was smaller. I don't know why. Yeah. That shows you what I know. I need to get hip to the tricks, you know?
You're hip to the tricks, I think.
many new cameras.
What did you shoot Footloose on?
Footloose was...
Oh, that was my slide.
That was your sink. Okay.
Slide,
Footloose.
Yeah.
Cut
yeah.
loose.
Yeah.
Footloose was Super 35, 3 perf. We shot on Arri cams.
Yeah.
And with Cook S4 primes. And a couple of Ingenue zooms.
Mm-hmm.
And... yeah, film.
And how did you, I mean, when you found out you were doing the remake of Footloose, it must have been like, oh, this is going to be the funnest thing in the world. I mean, well, that's what I would think, but I couldn't.
Well, having grown up a punk rocker in the days when Footloose was out, I didn't even know Footloose from nothing. It's like that wasn't our kind of
thing. That wasn't your thing.
No, I was a badass back then.
Right.
Not that, you know. Anyway, you know what I said to myself first is, like, if Craig Brewer's directing Footloose, that's going to be a blast.
Right.
I, you know, of course, went and watched the original Footloose immediately. And I started listening to Craig. Craig was still sort of pitching Footloose by the time we started talking about making the movie. So he was going through, he has this, I told you, he's a fantastic entertainer, and he sort of travels with his boombox, and he, you know, does the whole angry dance to, you know, he probably did that. I have it on flip camera. I have it on a whole bunch of different things because we'd rehearse and for the stunt guys or the effects guys or whatever. And Craig would just go through the whole thing the whole time, like doing all the moves. And he had the box playing and he's playing along with the music. Something to see. I'll
could he do the whole Let's Hear It for the Boys montage learning to dance?
Mm-hmm.
Sequence he could. Yeah. I used to do that in high school. They would make me, they would put me on the parking lot and blast it, and I had to. I actually do have decent rhythm. You wouldn't think so looking at this really nerdy guy.
You don't look nerdy to me.
Oh, wow. Hello.
You know, Footloose went through a few, there were a lot of people involved in terms of higher ups, you know, the people at Paramount and a few different production, I mean, producer camps. So there was a lot of people.
Politics to negotiate.
Yes, there were a lot of opinions, and they didn't all agree all the time. And Craig is not only charismatic, but he can work for the man right along the next one of them. And, you know, he listens to what the studio has to say, and if he feels really strongly differently, then he will discuss it. But, you know, you're making a movie that has a fan base that already exists, so there's a certain responsibility that Craig felt to that. And he was very faithful. He wrote the script with Dean Pitchford's script, you know, right by his side. And there's some stuff we stole, right? I mean, I don't think the look is nothing like
no.
the original, but there's definitely some dialogue and some... There's some referential stuff in there, enough referential stuff that I think the fan base from either from any end will be satisfied. You know, you have good car crashes, and you have a little
great
love
dances.
Interest, and a little country, and a little Blake Shelton to end the movie, and a little...
What was the look you were going for? When you set out, I mean, did you if somebody would have said, okay, so what are you? What's the look you're going for this movie? And it's a question that's so... generic and vague, and it's a question that often doesn't make any sense. But that being said, with that caveat, what would have been your answer?
In some ways, it's teen movie realism, but with an edge. You know, I didn't want to lose the Craig Brewer of it all, and for me, the big sort of transition or change from things I'd already done was collaborating with the choreographer on the.
Uh-huh.
And the dance pieces, and I went to all the dance rehearsals, and I would, back then we were still using flip cameras that are now obsolete, but we would use them for, you know, pre-production research and stuff, and talking about shots, and I would shoot a lot of dance rehearsals. I worked very closely with Jamal Sims, who's the choreographer, in terms of creating shots and shot design and lighting to fit the space, and it's interesting how many things you have to take into consideration when you're shooting dance, not the least of which is the surface upon which the dancers are dancing.
Right.
How many takes you can do because they get worn out, how many cameras you're using obviously facilitates that, but that was the newest thing for me in terms of shooting that movie, and that was what was really fun, was working with the choreographer and the shot design and a lighting design. Most of it was done as soft top light to be able to incorporate multiple angles at the same time and that kind of stuff. But as far as the look goes, I would say juicy realism.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Juicy. Very juicy.
Well, I think it's really important that the kids look attractive. You
right.
know, Julianne Hough and Kenny Wormald needed to look sexy and beautiful. Mm. And
It also probably helps when you're that young and look at that skin, you know what I mean? The wonderful, you know,
yeah.
skin.
Julianne is amazing. She's so beautiful. And her eyes, oh my goodness, those blue eyes.
Right.
Yeah. But I think there's another part of cinematography that people sometimes might not see, obviously, in the overall picture when it goes out to the theater. But a big part of our job is to provide a safe performance space for the director to work with the actors, whether it be a giant dance space or a space for Julianne, who is not... She was very new to the game. I think it was her second movie at the time. You know, providing... lighting and camera situations where the director has the freedom to work with the actors and doing that on a timely basis so that he has time to do coverage and stuff like that. And that was a big thing for me. It was just freeing Craig up so that he could do whatever he wanted to. I mean, I hopefully would know about that beforehand. Mm-hmm. But that's when you have true collaboration, is when you understand what the director needs and what pressures are on them, and you can free that up by making the right choices, not compromising the look per se, but making that director-actor thing really happen.
That's great.
That's our job.
What's next for you? Not in terms of like what have you got lined up, but what, you know, what are those types of stories that you want to be involved in telling next? Do you have a wish list? Do you have a checklist? Do you go?
Well, it's funny that you ask that, because I may be embarking on, as a tag-along, on a documentary that's actually being made by Chris Jordan, the still photographer. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. If you're not, you should check it out.
Okay.
He did the Hurricane Katrina book that was...
I think I have seen some of
this. It was very emotional.
Yeah,
his name's Chris Jordan anyway. Look him up. He's doing a film right now, or soon, it's still in fundraising stages, but there's been a trailer made called Midway, which is about an island where all the plastics from all over the world end up.
I've seen that trailer.
And you have?
Yeah.
Well, I am trying my damnedest, because I'm a huge fan of his photography,
right.
And I was about to go to NYU to be a full arts professor, and then we couldn't agree on, they didn't offer me enough money, and I just yesterday told them I couldn't do it for that money. We've been negotiating, going and interviewing and all that stuff since April. So now that I'm not doing that, I am so free right now. I am. I can go live anywhere. I can do anything. But the gallery, the Copacan Gallery, which is a still photography gallery in Los Angeles here, Paul and I also went to college together in Santa Cruz, and he's my way into some of these still photographers, and he is doing his best to get me in touch with Chris Jordan. We have very similar sensibilities about what we consider the responsibility of, social responsibility of photography and cinematography. And I was so moved by the stories of these birds and the plastics and the images that Chris has already captured that I basically volunteered.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll take me.
Have you ever seen the short film Isla de Flores?
Uh-uh.
The flowers? So there's a short film from the 80s called Island of Flowers, and I don't want to say anything about it. All I can say is the only film that I've ever seen where we were sitting in film school, film theory, and they put it up on the screen, and 15 minutes, start to finish, and half the room was crying. Half. So anyway, but it just reminded, when I saw the trailer for Midway, it made me think of...
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, it's such a long shot for me to actually get... I mean, Chris Jordan is like a hero of mine.
It's not such a long shot.
As is Mitch Dubrowski, if I'm saying his name right. He's the storm chaser still photographer who's kind of hot right now. That guy goes out and finds the stuff, and he finds it like this crazy, crazy, beautiful, natural lightning clouds, just incredible stuff. And there's definitely a spiritual element to that work. I'm trying to reconnect with what is important to me about the tools we use to tell stories, which comes down to composition and lighting and color. And sometimes it's hard to do that in the way this wicked world works, this business of movie making and stuff. So for me, because I'm a little free at the moment, since the course of life has just taken I'm not going east, I'm right here. But this is a funny story. I put my house on the rental market because I rented it.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, that's awesome. Everybody's like, oh my God, what are you going to do? I was like, it is so awesome. I can go anywhere. I'm still going to rent my house out. It's time for a new life for a little while. But, I'm hoping that Craig has another project coming soon. He has a few in the pipeline. But I'm also, I'm looking, of course we all need money and we need to pay our mortgages and stuff like that, but I'm really looking for, like, Chris Jordan's images really speak to me, and he's chosen a subject that, I guess I'm looking to find something like that to do either myself or to...
Something different.
I also really enjoy seeing how other people see the world, because the world of cinematography, it's very rare that we're on set with another cinematographer, so I sort of go to the still photographers or the documentarians and sort of see what they're doing because I think it's more honest.
Go ahead.
This part's full.
Oh, you gotta reload? Okay, we should wrap it up anyway.
Okay. I think still photography is more honest than what we do. They've got one chance to catch that thing. And yeah. Anyway, do you want me to say anything?
No,
I'm sweating
no.
now, so we better stop.
No, I'm all shy.
This one has
taken. I want you to say, thank you for joining us at ThroughTheLens.com. Okay, I'm kidding.
I will.
I'm kidding.
Hi, I'm Amy Vincent.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us
Vincent.
At ThroughTheLens.com. Did you get it?
No, we're recording
that.
But we're recording.
We're recording now?
No, so. You know, I think if I had to sum anything up, I think in this time mm-hmm. in the world, in the economy and the transitional government that we find ourselves in the United States of America, I hope that I can be part of myself and my colleagues as cinematographers to sort of re-up the power of the visual image and use it for the better good of the world as opposed to iPhones and GoPros and, you know, anything goes cinematography. I think that cinematography exists in everything that we do, whether it's a Mitt Romney campaign thing or, you know, the GoPros on the helmets of the motocross guys. It's all cinematography, but we as cinematographers by trade and by passion and by as artists would like to just get that back. I think people forget that there's a whole part of cinematography that you can't see, and it's the collaboration, it's the decisions about how best to use an image to tell a story, evoke an emotion, or get a message across. And they don't see all those conversations that we have or all those ponderings of things that might happen, but there's been a randomness and a lack of intention to a lot of work that gets out there now, as in any jackass can pick up an iPhone and shoot something.
Right.
But I beg to differ. No, I would really like the integrity of the art form to remain for quite some time.
And make sure the professionals are being acknowledged and that the work...
It's not the professional acknowledgement, it's the existence of cinematography as an art form. If you look back at the cinematography of James Wong Howe, it's like that guy was an artist and nobody doubted it. I mean, and people revered and respected cinematographers and cinematography as an art form. Now it's like, it's hard to get, we're working on it, I guess. It's cinematography as an art form is, needs some,
love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And that, you know, the ASC is well behind that, and I think it can be achieved through bringing the education to the film schools. I think it can be achieved by keeping a level of integrity in the work. I think it can be achieved by helping to train people in other departments about why the things we do are important, and that can be producers or art department folks or whatever, but don't let it go away because it's pretty great and it's really powerful when it's used properly.
Amy Vincent.
Yeah!
Thanks for joining us.